Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, with a severe financial crisis, there's been plenty of discussion and plenty of questions about a possible bankruptcy for the city of Detroit. But what would that really mean? Could it really happen? And what would it really mean for the state's economy? Also, Michigan has been marketing itself for more than a century. We'll look back at pure Michigan 19th century style. But first, there are bills moving through the state legislature right now that could have a big impact on adoptions here in Michigan, specifically adoptions through faith-based agencies. Michigan Radio's investigative reporter Lester Graham's been following this story for Michigan Watch. Lester, just what would these bills do?
In part, the bills would say a child-placing agency is not required to perform, assist, counsel, recommend, facilitate, refer, or participate in a placement that violates the child-placing agency's written religious or moral convictions.
Okay.
That's the bottom line there. This pair of bills also makes sure the government can't deny them a contract for placing children because of any kind of additional religious or moral requirements.
And so what we're really talking about are, for example, LGBT adoptive parents perhaps hoping to adopt from a Catholic agency? Is that the kind of reality?
It could be. It could be a lot of different things, though. The ACLU suggested an agency might decide it can't place children in homes where one of the prospective parents might have gone through a divorce, or if they believed in a way they find objectionable, or if they're lesbian and gay, as you have mentioned, or any reason that they happen to have in writing. You know, if you follow this logic, it would enshrine in law the right for a child-placing agency to choose parents who maybe only adhere to Sharia law, or an agency that would choose only homes where no religion is practiced, or an agency could discriminate basically based on anything, any reason it wants, as long as it's in writing and it doesn't violate federal law.
Now, where did this all begin? Why did someone decide that this was needed?
Well, this was introduced by the chair of the Families, Children, and Seniors Committee in the House, a guy named Kenneth Kurtz. He's the Republican there. And during testimony, Representative Kurtz described himself as a person of faith who didn't feel he could any longer sit by and watch religious liberties eroded by government interference. In fact, in a quote during the testimony, he said it would ensure people of faith can adhere to their convictions without any fear of reprisal from government administrations that want to discriminate against beliefs regarding how we should raise our children.
Now, were there concerns raised by the agencies, or, I mean, where did he get the sense that things are being eroded?
I think it's just a deeply held belief by him and many others in the legislature who feel that government interference in religious life has gone too far. There's also a fear that, as happened in Illinois, if they say, hey, look, here are the state requirements for qualifying you as a prospective adoptive parents, and you can't go beyond those state requirements. Well, Catholic Social Services in Illinois said, no, we've got a whole other set based on our religious beliefs of requirements for parents. If you say we're restricted only to these state requirements, we're going to have to shut down. And they did in Illinois. And that the Michigan Catholic Conference was testifying at one of the hearings, and they made it clear, we will shut down Catholic Social Services if this is not protected.
If that were to happen in Michigan, how important are faith-based agencies? How big a role do they play in adoptions in
Michigan? They're quite important. In fact, I mentioned Catholic Social Services. They alone place 1 in 10 of these foster kids into adoptive houses. There's another group called Bethany in Grand Rapids area, and they place a lot of kids over there too. I don't have precise numbers of how many of the adoption agencies are faith-based or somehow have some moral code that they follow beyond the state's requirements, but there are a good number. It would be important because, you know, the state is already having problems placing many of these foster kids into adoptive homes.
Now, it's time to get personal here. My ears really perked up when I heard Lester talking about this story because I was the very first baby put into a permanent adoptive home by Catholic Social Services of Oakland County. They had been doing foster care, but when it came time for a permanent adoption, when they wanted to make that move, there was a young couple in Ferndale, Michigan, who had been foster parents, and I guess it would be very heartbreaking when it would be time for that to end. And when they decided to move into permanent adoption, they placed me with Milton Marie Bruce of Ferndale, Michigan. So And that was then called Catholic Family Services, and now it's Catholic Social Services of Oakland County.
So you know how important this agency and others like it are.
I do.
The real question is, if for in a future administration, mm-hmm. the state says, all right, we're going to somehow violate your convictions. We're no longer going to allow you to use these set of criteria.
Right.
You have to stick to just what the state says are the qualifications. Then those services might shut down. At least that's what they say they will do.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes, well, would other adoptive agencies say, well, look, we don't have any criteria beyond what the state has already set
right.
out. We'll pick up those state contracts and we'll do those placements. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to look and see what Illinois has done since their Catholic Social Services shut down there to see if it's had any real impact on placement.
This is, I'm suspecting, kind of stems from the national conversation and the national tensions between the Catholic Conference of Bishops and the Obama administration.
It's yeah. another argument in that way. They're feeling that government is – and this may have – I can't tell you what really drove Representative
yes.
Kurtz to introduce this, but that may have had a role in this, the idea that government's going to come in and tell a religious organization how you're going to behave is really bothersome to a large segment of society.
And one can argue that if you are, you know, Catholic Social Services of any county, you can determine – who joins the club if it fits your belief. But then, as you pointed out, but they're taking state money.
Exactly. It's public money.
Mm.
And it's been argued by those who find fault with this that you're using public money to discriminate against anyone you want. Where is that right? We shouldn't be using public money to do that. You can't discriminate against prospective parents if you're on a state contract. That's their belief, you know, and really underlying all this is great concern among the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender
yeah.
Community that this is really just a backdoor way to make sure that these agencies can continue to place kids in other than gay households. So that is a real concern. And the last hearing, which was held yesterday, a gay couple came in with their adoptive son and said, hey, look, we hold religious beliefs too. We go to church. We take our son Lucas every Sunday. We understand how you want to protect religious liberties, but this goes beyond that. This goes you should be looking at finding loving homes that will take care of these kids, raise them properly. You're looking at saying, well, based on this set of criteria, we don't believe that you can provide that home, or we don't think that you should be raising kids. That's a real concern.
Have you had any conversations with administrators of the faith-based agencies? Because that question about if you're taking state money.
Yeah, actually, I had a long a long chat on the phone with the Michigan Catholic Conference who, after the first testimony, they were really concerned about some of the things they heard from some of the other groups like the ACLU that they felt weren't right. And we had a little debate on the phone about what was right and what was not right. And, you know, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm just trying to tell people what everyone's saying. And they're saying, well, you know, they were putting out some outrageous statements. And I questioned them, are you not threatening to shut down every Catholic Social Services agency in the state? It's not a threat. We're going to if we find that because we have to follow our Catholic convictions first.
That is true. So what's next?
Well, we don't know. This has been referred to the full House. We assume that it will come up from a vote. But I haven't heard anything in the Senate, whether they'll consider this or not, in the time that we have left in this lame duck session. So it might get a vote in the House, and that might be the end of it until and unless they introduce it in the next legislative session. But we're just not sure.
Lester, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Certainly.
Lester Graham, Michigan Radio, investigative reporter, following this story for Michigan Watch. Today is a sad day for music fans worldwide. Piano player, composer, and band leader Dave Brubeck died today. Dave Brubeck's quartet with Paul Desmond on the saxophone literally changed the tempo of jazz. Brubeck's famous song Take Five reached number one on the pop charts in 1959. And Time Out became the first instrumental jazz album to go gold. Brubeck was also known for bringing jazz outside of the club and into the concert hall. Beginning in the 50s, the jazz giant continually taught and toured on college campuses around the globe. His most famous college stint was here in Michigan for his landmark Jazz Goes to College album. Brubeck recorded this very song called The Song Is You at the University of Michigan's Hill Auditorium in 1954. The lyrics to the song are, "The music is sweet, the words are true, the song is you." Dave Brubeck was 91. He was one day shy of his 92nd birthday. Now I want to let you know about a special event Michigan Radio and Stateside are hosting. Tomorrow evening, I'm hoping you'll join me for cocktails and conversation. I want to meet you, and I really want to hear about the stories that you want told on Stateside. We'll be at Clada Irish Pub in Livonia from 5 to 7 p.m. Again, that's tomorrow evening. The Clada Irish Pub, it's on Haggerty between 6 and 7 Mile Roads, easily gotten to from M14 and I-275. You can find out even more details online. Go to michiganradio.org, and I really look forward to seeing you there. Still to come, just what makes you buy a car, that car? What's really behind the reason that you pick a certain brand or model? We'll find out coming up in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Stateside. Of the many stories making headlines in Michigan, the financial miseries of Detroit are relentless and unforgiving. Yesterday, officials said the city won't run out of cash this month, as earlier predicted. But Deputy Mayor Kirk Lewis says the city faces an even bigger than expected cash shortfall by the middle of next year. This all seems to make the prospect of Chapter 9 bankruptcy for the once proud city seem to grow with each passing week. But what would bankruptcy actually mean, both for residents of Detroit and for everyone else in Michigan? To help answer these questions, we welcome Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes and Mickey Maynard, author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Daniel, you have been sounding a steady drumbeat of warning in the pages of the Detroit News about the possibility of restructuring that would include Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Now, that word bankruptcy is used pretty freely. What would it really mean for a city like Detroit?
Well, I think it would mean a lot of things. It would mean clearly a very unforgiving restructuring process, because it would go out of the political, be much less political, and be judged and overseen by a federal judge. It would be very difficult for the image of the city. It would be the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of the country, when you twin that with the bankruptcies of General Motors and Chrysler, it is a pretty large stain on this state and on this city. It would be very difficult, probably last about at least 3 years, judging from earlier bankruptcies, which were of much smaller cities, very expensive. Some lawyers that I've talked to think we'll easily get in the hundreds of millions, low hundreds of millions of dollars in legal fees. And as I said, be very unforgiving to the employees, to some extent to the residents. It would be a very difficult process. And I think it would affect a lot of people. It would affect state bond ratings and certainly the credit ratings of neighboring localities like Oakland County, which has got the best credit rating in the state.
And when we say that about bond ratings and credit mm-hmm. ratings, how does that hit the person living in Grand Rapids? How does that hit them in the wallet?
Well, it costs their governments more to borrow money. And I think what's really, really important for state people around the state to understand is Detroit has no money. And if you go into traditional bankruptcy, you need to fund restructuring. And in a corporate setting, that's called debtor in possession financing. And that's usually a basket of money that's put together by a group of banks who have agreed with the business model and the restructuring plan and come forward with that. In the case of Detroit, that debtor in possession would essentially be the state of Michigan. Therefore, the money that would fund the restructuring and help Detroit pay its bills and get through that period, which could be a multi-year period, would effectively be backed by and or come from the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. It would be the DIP lender. There is no TARP and no federal government standing there waiting to do this. There are no consortiums of banks from the private sector that would fund a restructuring in Detroit. The restructuring would most likely have to be funded in some measure by the taxpayers of the state of Michigan.
I know, Mickey, as an automotive writer, you saw GM and Chrysler in similar straits. Do you hear echoes that kind of sound familiar as you hear these headlines about Detroit?
Absolutely. I think if Detroit were a corporation, it would already be in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. This is a situation that a lot of listeners are probably not familiar with the different types of bankruptcies. So if I can take a second, I'll just explain what we're facing. So if you're a corporation, you would go through Chapter 11, which allows you to restructure and reopen. If things are bad enough, like Hostess, mm-hmm. you go through Chapter 7, which essentially you liquidate and find buyers for your assets. With a municipal bankruptcy, we're talking about something called Chapter 9. There's a whole set of the bankruptcy code that just applies to this situation. One of the issues that Detroit faces, though, is nobody this big has ever gone into a municipal bankruptcy. You've had them in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You've had them in Orange County, California, and some smaller cities in California. But we're talking about a different animal here. And while I agree with Dan that the state would probably be the first line of funding for this, it's such a unique situation. And the fact that you're dealing with a federal bankruptcy court, that I think the Obama administration will at some point get pulled into the situation, possibly not directly, but certainly indirectly, because if you think about General Motors and Chrysler, how important Detroit is to the Obama administration, the city of Detroit with a black Democratic mayor is going to be probably equally as important. So I see some sort of federal role in this. I don't know yet what it is because we're not there, but I don't think this will get all the way to the finish line without the federal government weighing in some way.
That's an interesting point of debate, and I understand the reasoning of why Mickey gets there, and in some senses that makes sense. What's been described to me by some bankruptcy lawyers about Chapter 9 and the differences, two things that are important here, I think. The Chapter 9 law is only 11 pages in the bankruptcy code, which is about 4 inches thick.
Wow.
It has not been explored very much. In fact, in this district, the Sixth Circuit of four states, they've only been able to find one example where this has been done, and it was in a hospital district. It is not something that is widely used. The judges who sit on the court currently have never seen this kind of stuff before. So I think that's a very important point to keep in mind.
So new ground is being broken.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing that was pointed out to me, which gets to the federal point that Mickey's making, is that under Chapter 9, because it's government entities, the 10th Amendment of the Constitution comes into play here. So there are limits to what the federal government can do in terms of what it can tell states it has to do. Mm. And this is the way you have to manage, let's say, a Detroit bankruptcy. And federal bankruptcy judges in these situations are loath to get involved in governance issues. They will look at financial aspects and restructuring, but they're not going to tell the city of Detroit or the state of Michigan how they have to manage this, because that could be perceived as a breach of the 10th Amendment of the Constitution.
So it's like a minefield.
It's new territory. And one of the most interesting things when you read the bankruptcy code is it says that the judge does not replace elected officials. It is not supposed to affect any political bodies that are already in place. Well, if you look at Detroit, one of the whole issues with Detroit is the relationship between the mayor and city council. Mm-hmm. So if essentially a judge is, you know, just like your mom who you go to every so often to say, okay, you gave me $5 in allowance, here's how I spent it. You know, mom's not going to get in the middle of it between you and your brother. So mm-hmm. if we just have a trustee or an overseer or however you want to think of the federal judge, but all the political infrastructure is left to fight mm-hmm. it out?
To fight it out.
What good is that going to do?
Well, but what the federal judge can do, she's absolutely right, but what they can do is they do have the power to abrogate contracts.
That's right.
Ultimately, so they could do some of the things that the old Emergency Manager Law, Public Act 4, that's been set aside mm-hmm. would have done. he's able to do that. The judge is also able to say, you know, you can't the city can't afford X and Y and Z, therefore we find in favor. The third problem with Chapter 9 in the context of Detroit, as it's been described to me, is it's not clear who's in charge. Because of the charter, and just like in any kind of bankruptcy filing, you have a debtor. Mm-hmm. Well, who would the debtor be? Would it be Mayor Dave Bing or his successor? Would it be the city council president or the city council? Would it be the corporation counsel, Crystal Crittenden, who appears to be running the show in a lot of ways, or at least having veto power over various decisions and proposals by the mayor?
A non-elected
It's
person.
Almost – there's this legal thicket that surrounds the 11th floor at City Hall that makes it much more difficult to even figure out who you'd be dealing with. And as I talk to people in Lansing, their concern right now isn't so much city council. Well, that is a politically dysfunctional body. It's the corporation council, because she seems to be in a position to be able to block and stop anything that they try to do to move the ball forward. Meanwhile, as you said in your open, the financial situation worsens and worsens. We've now found out that they would go from $47 million deficit by June of next year to an $84 million deficit. And by the way, this is an administration that consistently gets its numbers wrong. It consistently underestimates its spend and overestimates its revenue.
And that's one of the issues. If you do get the federal courts involved, we will get more transparency on the Detroit situation. We may see things going back years that we didn't know about. And, you know, we've certainly a lot has come out in the trials of Kwame Kilpatrick, mm-hmm. but there may be things stuffed in closets about the financial condition of Detroit that will have to list all of its contracts. There's going to be stuff that gets sunshine that has never gotten sunshine before. And Dan was saying earlier, 3 years. I think 3 years might be optimistic.
Oh, I think
this could go on for the rest of this decade.
Yeah, wow. I think she's right. I mean, we don't know.
Yes,
I mean,
sure.
That 3 year was thrown out by a guy I talked to a lot who looks at what's happened in California, particularly that's where most of these have happened, have been in California. The Harrisburg case that she mentioned was one of the few contentious ones where counsel filed Chapter 11 without the approval of the state and the mayor. Mm. So the federal judge kicked it and said, not, you can't going to do that. And actually, they're right now, they're getting another bite at the apple, which they may or may not take. But in a lot of these cases, particularly the Harrisburg case, the Central Falls, Rhode Island case, these states were, and cities were pushed over the edge because of specific issues. In the case in Detroit, it's just kind of a general financial collapse and mismanagement. And I think Mickey's exactly right. In fact, there are people that say that one of the reasons politicians are pushing back as hard as they are, I think one of it's control, and two is what are people going to find?
And I think that's why I mentioned the federal role earlier, because everything Dan was talking about with the different players in this, mm-hmm. that's all got to be straightened out before the filing takes place. I think the only person who can do that is probably the president or the administration. You have to get the governor involved. You have to get all the city folks. You have to get everybody in a room like they did with the auto companies back in 2009 and essentially say, this is what you're going to do.
I want to talk about Governor Snyder. First, I want to just let anyone know, if you've just joined us, you're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, and with me today, Detroit News writer Daniel Howes and writer Mickey Maynard, and we're exploring the possibility and the prospects of bankruptcy for the city of Detroit and what it means for all of Michigan. Daniel, take us through the political challenges that are facing Rick Snyder right now and really the state legislature. Oof. Yeah.
Well, there are lots. And it's not just the city of Detroit. I mean, the governor, I think, historically has been Detroit's not going to go bankrupt. And this week he's starting to be more open about and raising the prospect and basically saying if they can't get this thing, get some things on the table and dealt with, this city is headed for bankruptcy. And I think Rick Snyder faces a number of very difficult issues right now that will define his tenure as governor. This is one of them. The bankruptcy of Detroit and or the workout that they're going to try to engineer is going to be one. And the other one that he's facing, which is a little off topic, is whether or not there's going to be a right-to-work legislation in Michigan. Those two things will, I think, define his how he decides to go and what direction he goes will define his governorship. Because Michigan and the city of Detroit will look very different when he runs for reelection than they do today, depending on which way he goes. But politically, I think the challenges for him in Detroit are enormous. There's also some real opportunity. You see what's happening. You know, there's two things that are happening on parallel tracks here. As Detroit continues to collapse financially, you're seeing more and more private capital flooding into the city of Detroit. Dan Gilbert at Quicken Loans continues to buy up real estate. There's everybody from Blue Cross Blue Shield to the hospitals to Midtown to now the Illich family is announced a big their intention to develop something in the city of Detroit with the help of the state. Obviously, that's kind of their style.
New home for the Wings.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. All that kind of stuff I think is a very positive, because I think the people who are making these decisions, these investment decisions, think that stuff's going to change. They're business people. They know that bankruptcy as a general proposition means a new start. Now, it either means the liquidation and selling off of a company or, in the case of a government, a restructuring. You can't liquidate a government. Creditors can't even force the sale of assets under Chapter 9 like they can under Chapter 11. Creditors can't file a competing plan of reorganization. They're not even called a plan of reorganization in Chapter 9. They're called a plan of adjustment. And the only people that can file that are the debtor, which would be some form of, as we discussed,
sure,
some form of city government. But it wouldn't be, let's say, a fireman or police pension fund that is a creditor, or it wouldn't be some bank that's a creditor. They can't do that. They can't force the sale of assets. They can't force the sale of Belle Isle to a developer.
I'm hearing Eminem in my head while I'm listening to Dan because you get one shot. This bankruptcy of the city of Detroit is a one-time historic opportunity for a municipal restructuring. I'm just thinking about Dan Gilbert, the Illiches, all the folks who are representing that piece of Detroit. I'm thinking about all the political folks. You're going to have a room filled with Detroit VIPs who all have the same objective. They want to see this city fixed because they've invested in the city. They believe in the city. They feel like this is a turning point for Detroit. I was just talking about this yesterday with someone, and I said, think about all the progress that Detroit has made since the bankruptcy and how its image has really turned nationally. That it, you know, of course, Detroit will always be haunted by RoboCop and crime and the murder capital, but it's turning. The Chrysler ads have played a role. The hipsters moving into Detroit, Dan Gilbert investing in Detroit. Everybody's noticed that. And so if Detroit were to basically say that was just a blip in our history and we're going to fall into this abyss, that's a huge lost opportunity. On the flip side of it, there are people who really care, and that group might not have been there 5 years ago.
Huh.
So you have this moment. I really do see 2013 as a true turning point for the city of Detroit. Either it goes forward with everything that Dan was talking about, or it just slips back into chaos, the kind of chaos that we've been used to seeing for the last 50 years of its history.
And I'll bet on the first part.
You're betting on the first part?
Yeah, I think Mickey's right. I think it's going to turn. Where I think she and I would diverge is on the whole federal role. It seems to me that if a governor is not a legitimate inner cedar, if you will, in the situation in Detroit, a president of the United States isn't.
Well, I think there's a couple things that have to happen. First of all, we have this debate in Lansing over the public manager law and also right to work. There are some people who think if you give the mayor the power to abrogate labor contracts again, that that's enough, that that's the real problem, and that will take care of Detroit. I don't happen to think that. I think we have to get into those finances. We have to fix that. We have to get sunshine in on those doings in Detroit.
To see what's buried under the rocks.
Yeah. So that's the first. There's two things for listeners. So people in Grand Rapids and up in Flint should watch for two things. First of all, what happens in Lansing with Public Act 4, with the emergency manager law, and or right to work. Second, watch for payless paydays in Detroit, because payless paydays can trigger a whole bunch of actions with bondholders, with lenders, with others. So kind of make mental notes on those two things. If you see no action on right to work or the emergency manager law, if you start to see payless paydays, then that's what gets us closer to the decision about a Detroit bankruptcy.
I think that's right. there's no question that that those are the triggers. And another trigger, and that's actually on the table right now, is a missed pension payments.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor's administration is telling people we've got to deal with some of this quickly, and so this is going to happen pretty fast. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. I've pushed some bankruptcy people and say, what are the triggers? And there really isn't a single trigger necessarily, as long as the state and they kind of kite this thing along a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's a limit to what they're going to be able to do.
Many, many insights and lots. You've given us lots to keep our eye on as the weeks unfold. Always good to talk to both of you. Mickey Maynard, thank you so much. Daniel Howes, Detroit News, thanks for joining us in the studio here at Stateside.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a look back at how Michigan marketed itself more than 100 years ago. That's in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Have you noticed an uptick in car ads when you're watching TV lately? Well, you're on to something. November and December are two of the highest earning months for the auto industry. They want to sell. So what really moves a customer from his or her living room chair and into a showroom? The list of features, incentives, rebates, prices, or something more amorphous, a sense of brand? Let's explore this with Michael Bernacki. He's a marketing professor at the University of Detroit Mercy, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you, Cynthia?
Good, good. Well, I was thinking as I was turning over this idea of auto ads, and it popped in my mind going back to like 1980, 81, and there was Lee Iacocca showing off that Chrysler K car and saying, if you can find a better car, buy it. And then I thought of the famous Chrysler Super Bowl 2011 spot with Eminem and the Selected of God choir. Could you compare and contrast those ads and what they're telling consumers?
Sure. You know, in the K-Car ad with Iacocca, of course, he was challenging the public to see if they could match that particular car during that particular time. And he really wanted them to compare brands, to go out and to see what they could find. But there's a hidden agenda there. And the hidden agenda is, with that challenge, the assumption is made that he has already resolved the challenge. And probably, you know, that it's going to connect in favor of the brand that he is advertising. The Super Bowl ad with Eminem was really an amazing happening because it called attention to Detroit. The Made in Detroit brand, of course, was brought forward. And the whole idea of the renaissance, not only of the automobile industry in Detroit, but, of course, you know, the Chrysler brand itself. So it was an extraordinary event that caught everybody's attention and, of course, a lot of buzz throughout the country. And by the way, brought some real prominence to the Chrysler brand in part of its recovery.
And that was the marketing director, Olivier Francois, coming in from Europe with fresh eyes. And I saw the story that was in the Free Press this past weekend about him. And he said he was pretty appalled when he first came to America and he saw the traditional bombardment of MPGs and features and incentives. And I loved it. Prices ending in 99. So what is he on to as he kind of upended advertising for automotive products on its ear with that ad?
You know, what he stated, of course, indeed, is that there is more to an automobile than it just being the sum of its components, the sum of its features. Although I must say, some features today speak loudly and clearly, in particular, of course, a feature of miles per gallon, as you mentioned,
sure,
because of all the difficulty with gas prices and oil prices, et cetera. And today it almost goes without saying that somewhere in the litany of features, there better be something regarding what it is that you get when you're driving a car.
Mm.
Now, having said that, isn't it a wonderful idea if somehow, if you can connect to a brand and the brand itself speaks to various features? Because if you can do that, you already are on a winning team. In other words, you can make the assumption that some of the features are going to be there, and different brands are featured, of course, differently, whatever it happens to be. But the brand is a single statement of excellence, a single statement of what that automobile happens to be. And if you can obtain brand loyalty, That's the way to San Jose when you're selling automobiles.
So give us some other examples, Mike Bernacki, of commercials and ad efforts that you think work particularly well in giving us that sense of brand.
Sure. You know, of course, there's a litany of them. And as you mentioned, I'd like to start with all of the amazing number of ads that we see during November and December.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while it is not the autos industry number one selling time of year, it's at the top of the marketplace in terms of total revenue by any retailer. Now, why does it do so well, and how can it really compete, you know, on the holiday stage? Well, I'll tell you how it can, and it does, because it is the end of the year, of course, and so everybody wants to sell last year's models and the opening of the new year, and of course they want to get a foothold on the new model. So there's deals and spiels out there like never before. And if you've noticed, by the way, that there are more luxury cars that kind of get the acclaim and the ads this time of year, and that's indeed the case.
Yes.
Because luxury cars are very popular, and by the way, P.S., we are in a recovering economy, thank you very much, even with the fiscal cliff and all the uncertainty that there is. Luxury cars sell very well this time of year. You mean that somebody might eschew some other holiday gift purchase and buy an automobile? You better believe it. So, you know, it's a composite of those things that really brings the auto industry gangbusters into the holiday season. Now, looking at specific ads, you may remember a few years ago, and I'll try to stir imaginations and memories by taking a look at some Super Bowl ads. The Super Bowl ad that Hyundai, we already talked about the Chrysler ad,
right,
the one that Hyundai brought forward, and it was 3, 4, 5 years ago. And what it did, it decided that it was sick and tired of the American public mispronouncing its name. And the whole idea of the Hyundai versus Hyundai, and it's almost laughable, but guess what? That statement during the Super Bowl said to everybody, look, we are a brand to be reckoned with. We compete very effectively, as a matter of fact, as memory serves. There were more foreign vehicle comparisons in there. And they just wanted to say, you know, we're here to stay. And by the way, we have a brand, and the brand is, please pronounce it correctly, Hyundai, not Hyundai. Now, what I found so interesting about that ad, it did not rate very well on the Super Bowl ad meter by USA Today, but it made an extraordinary impression and let everybody know that, guess what, we're part of the mix now, the South Korean marketers.
We're here to stay. Is that kind of related to, I'm hearkening back a few years when Volkswagen had that Fahrwerksnugen, and that's the word you'd see. They'd use it in print ads, and you'd go, what's that? Then you realized it was, they were talking about the bug.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There is no doubt about it. And, you know, we can even move forward to this coming Super Bowl 2013, and guess what automobile is going to be introduced or reintroduced? And that is, of course, the new Lincoln. The reformed Lincoln.
Yes.
Yeah. Lincoln's done a lot of things to refurbish that brand. And boy, is it in a tough market, the luxury car market, which really Lincoln has abdicated for a number of years, domestically speaking, versus Cadillac. So they're going to have a 60-second ad, and that stands out by itself because, of course, the foray of ads are usually 30 seconds.
Yes.
And, of course, now they're called the Lincoln Car Company, going back to their, you know, original birth, if you will, in the 1920s, and they want to set themselves apart and aside and to be able to compete in the luxury car market. That is a monstrous task. What did they choose? Where did they decide to go? Their selection of the Super Bowl was, we're here, we're going to play, and we're going to make sure that we're going to be recognized as the luxury brand that we are. And they're going to take on Cadillac and, of course, all the foreign brands. This is going to be a monumental task, and whether they win or lose really right now is not the issue. The issue is how they decided to play the game.
Well, let's just say this. People still talk about the M&M spot and even Chrysler's Halftime in America pep talk that happened. So that Super Bowl advertising really, really matters. University of Detroit Mercy Marketing Professor Michael Bernacki, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
And now, it's one of the most successful ad campaigns in Michigan history.
Carpools, conferences, microwave dinners. They blur one into the next. We lose ourselves in the fog of everyday life and drift away from what matters. But like a beacon in the night, it finds us. The light of more than 100 lighthouses burning through that fog and beckoning us back to what's real and true. This light shines for us all. This light is Pure Michigan. Your trip begins at Michigan.org.
And, of course, that is the Pure Michigan campaign, credited with luring 3.2 million out-of-state visitors to Michigan and producing something like $1 billion in new revenue. But long before Tim Allen stepped up to a microphone to sing Michigan's praises, long before the soundtrack from the Cider House Rules became synonymous with the Great Lakes State, marketing wizards were coming up with ads designed to lure tourists to northern Michigan. You can call it Pure Michigan 19th century style. Joining us is Michael Federspiel, who's executive director of the Little Traverse Historical Society, and he teaches history at Central Michigan University. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So when we talk Pure Michigan 19th century style, how far back are we looking?
Well, when we look at the beginning, really, of the advertising campaign, it's primarily associated with the arrival of the railroads, roughly from the 1870s on in northern Michigan.
And so the railroads are coming in. Northern Michigan is there. It's as beautiful then as it is today. So what was the thrust of the advertising?
Well, it is as beautiful as it is today, with the exception of it looked kind of scarred in many areas because the lumber industry had kind of moved in and moved its way out again.
Wow.
And it was an area looking for an identity, looking for an economic basis. And it was an area that the government was giving land grants to railroad companies to try to encourage them to build rail lines to bring people to populate regions. And so with the granting of land to the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad Company, you saw them looking then to market their land and market themselves for customers. And so that campaign began in earnest by the late 1870s.
So unlike today's Pure Michigan campaign, the one we just heard, that's bankrolled by the state government. But the funding of advertising in the 1800s were the railroad companies then.
Indeed, and it was an indirect funding, if you will, because that Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad Company was given upwards of 800,000 acres to build a rail line from Grand Rapids to northern Michigan as a land grant, as a gift from the federal government in that occasion to try to encourage them to get people to settle in the area. And so then they, the railroad company, turned around and began to publish annual brochures, and they would extol the northern Michigan that we know today for sportsmen. They would try to encourage people to come and to be day tourists or occasional tourists. They would eventually move into encouraging people to come and stay at resorts. And the group that they never quite caught on with quite as well were farmers. And originally they thought that they would be able to market northern Michigan for farmers, encouraging Civil War veterans to go there. But the promises of a long growing season and cold and mild winters without cold, deep frost and deep, luscious, fertile soil kind of fell flat. And so those tourists became more of the target as opposed to the settlers and the farmers.
So it truly seems that the big pitch, the big thrust of the tourist advertising wasn't too different than what we hear Tim Allen doing today.
It's really the exact same. If you look at the Pure Michigan campaign today, they show you beautiful images. During those years when the railroads were in charge of this kind of publicity, they would create booklets, annual booklets. The Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad Company rebranded itself the Fishing Line and produced hundreds of thousands of color booklets that they would have in hotels, in railroad stations. And they would have line sketches and drawings of the northern Michigan sunsets and the streams of northern Michigan. And they would really point to northern Michigan where you could be very active, or where you could be not active at all, that you could lay back and just enjoy the quiet breeze.
And who was being targeted? Where were these being handed out?
That's another commonality. The Pure Michigan campaign really targets primarily non-Michiganians, targets people in the whole Midwestern region as well as Canada, and the same would have been true of Grand Rapids in Indiana. Their primary focus would have been Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Indianapolis, Cleveland to a lesser extent, but they were looking to haul for the long haul those people in northern Michigan, and people in particular in urban environments where the hot, sweltering summers and the polluted conditions made a northern Michigan cool summer with crisp, clean air particularly appetizing.
Well, all they needed was Rachel Portman music and Tim Allen's vocal cords,
exactly.
And they would have it.
And it just is remarkable. When you lay the technique and the advertising strategies of one over the other, they really do line up, and particularly in that whole Midwestern appeal. And that's why when you're in northern Michigan in the summertime, you'll see dozens, if not hundreds, of out-of-state license plates. And we sometimes assume automatically those are just day tourists. People are in just for the day. But when you look at some of those families, they've been in northern Michigan for six generations because they came in those initial campaigns, families including Ernest Hemingway's family that in 1898 saw those same kind of advertisements and decided to come to northern Michigan around Petoskey. And once there, you know, they discovered that this was a place they wanted to spend some time, bought property, and then would continue to come for the rest of Ernest Michigan years. And the Hemingway family still owns that original cottage.
So those cottages could be great-great-great-grandpas, and it's still in the family. And I, you know what? I never did think of that those folks that could be up there, it's not just a one-shot trip to Michigan.
And that's one of the unusual things about that little Traverse Bay region in particular is you have resort communities such as Bayview and Wequitancing and Harbor Point, Roaring Brook, that really were founded starting in those 1870s, very shortly after the railroads arrived, and they had their own rules and their own identity, and they were places where people came and they spent the season. You know, they came at the start of the summer, left at the end of the summer, and with some legitimacy, you know, claim that they are locals. You know, they may not live there year-round, but their family has been in that area for over 100 years often.
Overall, then, was the 19th century version of Pure Michigan as smashingly successful as the 21st century version?
I would say it probably depends on your measure, and if you did some calculating for the inflation of money at the time, mm-hmm. I think you would have to say yes. And it had a different wrinkle, though, really, too. Today's program promotes people to come to an existing place with existing businesses. That first version of it, really, in the midst of luring people to the North was building that tourist economy. They were building those luxurious hotels. They were building dining rooms where you could have oysters prepared seven different ways. You know, they were building the local tourist attractions as well. Today, those are all there. They're clearly defined, and we promote people to go there. And today also, we have that year-round aspect, especially the winter tourism with snowmobiling and skiing that was not a part of that originally. Originally, it would have been really exclusively that June through September window when that tourist season opened up and then closed.
But it does seem to me, as I'm hearing you talk about this, that what we all grew up thinking of as that vacation destination of up north could have been totally different if they had not made that big push. It might have become agriculture, or it might have just kind of been there without anything special.
Well, and we all know of communities in northern Michigan whose heyday was that lumber era. Now they've kind of dried up into these small little enclaves. But that west coast, that northwest coast of Michigan, was not to be that way. And we've mentioned the railroad companies, but you also have to remember the steamship companies plied those waters from Chicago up to Mackinac, back and forth. They, too, had their own set of advertisements. And then the locals were not far behind in terms of promoting it as a regional destination. Local businesses, chambers of commerce came together and you know, produced their own literature and their own brochures, their own advertisements. So you had multiple agencies, if you will, or multiple interests that were promoting you to come on up and stay in their town at their hotels, use their excursions, and use their mode of transportation to and fro.
So it certainly seems when we're talking about tourism in northern Michigan that old adage holds true that everything old is new again.
That is exactly right.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Mike Federspiel, who is Executive Director of the Little Traverse Historical Society and a history professor at Central Michigan University.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered today by Mark Brush. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow at 3:00.